Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor of Cure Talk, Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you for a discussion on prostate cancer. All Cure Panel shows on prostate cancer are conducted in association with the Prostate Cancer International and Prostate Cancer Foundation. This is the fourth time we are discussing prostate cancer on the Cure Panel platform, and we have had over 10,000 people listen to our prostate cancer shows. Our previous show had Dr. Bruce J. Roth of Washington University talk about hormone therapy for advanced prostate cancer. Today we have with us a very distinguished guest, Professor Mark Emberton of University College London Hospital. Mr. Emberton is the Director of the Division of Surgery and Interventional Science at University College London. He is also UCL Partners Pathway Director for Urological and Oncology for London Cancer, a provider network serving 4 million people that live north of the River Thames in London. He is the Honorary Clinical Director of the Clinical Effectiveness Unit at the Royal College of Surgeons of England. As Professor of Interventional Oncology at UCL, he leads a clinical innovation team that majors in experimental medicine by combining bioengineering and nanotechnology with early phase trials in men with prostate cancer. He is an active researcher, lectures widely, and has published over 200 peer-reviewed articles in numerous scientific journals. Mark Emberton is a founding partner of London Neurology Associates. He is also a trustee of the charity Prostate Action. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Hello. Greetings from London.
My co-host for the show is Michael E. Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, a prostate cancer-specific not-for-profit educational and informational organization based in Virginia. Mike is an executive vice president of Independence Healthcom Strategies Group, a privately held group of healthcare communications companies based in Philadelphia. He is also the current board chairman of the National Organization for Rare Diseases and a member of the board of directors of the International Myeloma Foundation. Mike, great to have you, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Priya. Thank you for the invitation. And good afternoon, Mr. Emberton. How are you today?
Extremely well, extremely well. Looking forward to the discussion.
So perhaps we should
supporting...
begin with... Oh, I'm sorry. You go ahead, Priya.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Thank you, Mike. Supporting Professor Emberton and Mike on the panel are experienced and knowledgeable prostate cancer survivors and advocates Jim Wickstrom, Richard Davis, and Alan Edel. I extend a hearty welcome to all panelists and to all our listeners. Today we are discussing focal therapy and HIFU for prostate cancer. Decades after lumpectomy became a standard option for women with breast cancer, men are seeking a similarly targeted approach to prostate cancer, one that gets rid of the tumor while preserving the organ. This is sensible for many reasons, starting with the fact that the golf ball-sized gland is inaccessible. It lies deep within the pelvic cavity, surrounded by sensitive structures that are vital to sexual and urinary health. The urgency has never been greater. The PSA screening test, once seen as a life-saving early detection tool, is no longer recommended by health experts because too many men are being treated for cancers that, left alone, would not become life-threatening. With the disease estimated to kill 30,000 American men a year, despite a 30% reduction in deaths since the PSA was introduced in the late 1980s, and being urged to use an option men find nerve-wracking, that is, monitor rather than treat early-stage cancer, hoping it doesn't grow, targeted ablation is seen as a possible solution to this dilemma, at least for some patients. On today's show, we will be learning more about developing applications of HIFU that is high-intensity focused ultrasound and focal therapy, removal of tissues from only selected areas of the prostate in the management of early-stage localized prostate cancer. I would like to remind our listeners that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the end of the show. With that, now I hand over to Mike to begin with the discussion. Mike, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya. So, Dr. Emberton, perhaps you can spend a little time telling us about the basics of HIFU and other therapies and how that are of similar potential and how they can be used in focal therapy. And one of the things I would particularly like you to delineate for us is where you start to draw lines between the patients who may be good candidates for active surveillance and those who really, you know, will benefit from therapy and the issues that come up in your discussions with patients about those.
Thanks. Well, that's a great starting point. So I think it's probably worth starting just reflecting on the last 100 years of treating prostate cancer since radical prostatectomy was first done at the beginning of the last century. And all our treatments have been directed at the gland rather than the cancer because of our inability to localize the cancer within the prostate. And that's the thing that's changed. So what we're able to do is transition from an era where we were blind to cancer location to an era when we're not. And it's just worth reflecting what happened in other organ systems when that opportunity became evident. And in urology, within my working lifetime, we transitioned from radical nephrectomy, removing the kidney in everybody with any tumor, small or large, to a much more individualized approach where some tumors we watch, some tumors we ablate, and where we can, and in most patients today, we try and preserve as much kidney as possible in the knowledge that that benefits patients in the long term. You know, before my time, the revolution happened in breast cancer, and indeed, if we look at all the solid organs around the body, it's just the prostate that we insist on removing in its totality because of our so-called inability to localize disease. And it's also interesting is that of all the tumors I've discussed and the many I haven't, prostate overall is the least lethal of them. And so it should be possible, if it's possible in more lethal tumors like kidney cancer, which has a 50% overall five-year survival, it should be possible to do this in prostate cancer, which has, you know, a 90 to 95% 10-year survival in most of the studies that we've looked at. And I think the opportunity really is a convergence of technology. It's the ability to localize the tumor with MRI, and I think that's one technology now that is gaining enormous attention. The second technology is the ability to sample that area accurately, and image registration, which is a kind of product of computational science, is now fairly mature. There are about 10 companies now offering MRI to ultrasound registration systems, something that the neurosurgeons have been using for 5 to 10 years, but is just starting to come into urology. And the third technology that was hitherto missing is now available are technologies that allow us to place energy within small volumes of tissue and importantly preserve the structures between the release of that energy and the product of that energy, which is the focal point of treatment. And the HIFU is one example of that, and there are many others that I'm sure we will discuss. So those are the three things that have all really emerged in the last decade at slightly different times, but are now all fairly mature to allow us to have as our therapeutic target the cancer rather than the prostate. And that's essentially the background to this research question that we're asking. So, you know, can we do it? And if we do it, can we preserve oncological efficacy? In other words, can we cure patients, stop them progressing? And if we can we do so without detriment to their genitourinary function? And we'll talk about the results of some of those studies which tell us the extent to which we've achieved those goals. But I'll stop there for now just to see in which direction you want me to go to in terms of your questioning.
I'm perfectly happy for you to go right ahead. I think you've set up the groundwork just fine, and I think the important thing is for you to give us a straightforward review of where you think we're at, and then we can probably have detailed questions after that.
Okay. So I think when you explain this to patients, the patients get it, and very quickly, because obviously they place high utility on the preservation of function. And they appreciate that technology can allow us to have cancer as our target, rather than the whole organ, which we do in the colon, in the bladder. Urologists are very comfortable treating lesions, small lesions, when and as they occur, and in the knowledge that they will recur, because removing the bladder is such a catastrophe to the patient's quality of life. But urologists also recognize that there are some patients who need their bladder removed, who have particularly aggressive disease, disease that recurs, or widespread disease. And if we look at the breast, all women have mastectomy 30, 40 years ago. Now only one-third of the women that present with breast cancer require a mastectomy, but there is still a group that do, and they obviously have widespread aggressive disease. So it was said at the beginning that a tissue-preserving or selective therapy for patients will not be for everybody. And at the moment, we're in the process of defining who it is that is most likely to benefit from such a treatment. And there are several issues that are discussed, and when we have this discussion in public amongst urologists or with patient groups, certain themes and questions tend to emerge. The first, I think, is that does tissue preservation matter? And I think we know the answer to that. And this is a side effect question. We don't need 15 to 20 years of follow-up to ascertain whether erections and continence is preserved. And there have now been several thousand patients treated in a focal manner, only a couple of hundred in formal registered prospective studies. But even in those couple of hundred who've been very, very carefully evaluated, there's no difference in baseline function prior to treatment and after treatment with respect to erections and urinary continence, which I think is a real revolution, indicating quite emphatically that preserving tissue makes a difference. And I think the reason it does make a difference is that most of the harms associated with therapy come not from treating the prostate itself, but from damaging important structures that surround it. And they include rectum, ureteric sphincter, which is the muscle that we use to interrupt our urinary stream, the nerves that run just down the side of the prostate that mediate erections, the bladder neck that's important in ejaculation and also in continence in some men, and also the bladder, which can get affected by sometimes surgery and sometimes radiotherapy that can result in frequency and urgency. And by limiting the harm, if you like, just to the cancer cells in a small area around it, all you treat is prostatic tissue, most hopefully prostate cancer cells, but obviously you have to apply a small margin, and very little collateral damage occurs as a result. And that's the reason, I think, why you can treat somebody with focal treatment, and you can see them, as we did several patients yesterday, and you ask them about continence, it's the same. You ask them about erections, it's the same. You ask them even about their ejaculation, and if not quite the same, it's still present but slightly reduced in terms of volume. And so those are the kind of outcomes that we're trying to create. And I think now there is good evidence that you can do that by treating anything up to or less than half the prostate. So that's that aspect. I think the other thing that we know about definitely without any uncertainty is the safety profile, in that also issues of toxicity can be derived early, and we have enough patients in prospective trials and registries to know that the toxicity levels, in other words, the complications and harms associated with therapy are low. We've got comparative data now in the public domain in the New England Journal of Medicine this year from the PIVOT study, which shows that 20% of men are incontinent of urine and 70 to 80% of men are impotent after surgery, twice as many as would be with surveillance. So I think that's quite emphatic. What we don't know, of course, are the long-term oncological outcomes, because as we've learned from other studies, is that that requires probably 10, almost certainly 15 years to derive in this medium risk group that I think and many others think are probably the ideal patients to receive this treatment. And therefore, men who choose to have this treatment have to do so without any certainty in long-term data, just as the men who had radical prostatectomy in the 90s had to, or radiotherapy indeed in the 80s. And that's obviously something that has to be shared with men. We do have short-term data. Some would call it medium-term data. So in other words, sampling the prostate after a given interval, after an intervention, and we can get freedom of disease. The various definitions that are out there, they're all slightly different, but they all try and confer some notions of freedom of disease. And they vary depending on the study and the time frame between 82 and 94% of patients are free of disease in short to medium terms, which again compares very favorably with other treatments. Beyond that, we just have to wait and see. The other kind of uncertainty area of debate, and this again was alluded to earlier, is who is the right recipient for focal treatment. And this requires a conceptual change in thinking, as well as defining a lower and upper threshold of risk. And the conceptual change in thinking, I think, is probably the most difficult one, and it relates to multifocality. We've learned, I think, recently, or fairly recently, that multifocality exists in all cancers, but the progression of the very small cancers is uncertain. And the best kind of metaphor for this is a weather one, I think, is that predicting the weather a long way away from your from the time that you're predicting is very, very difficult to do, just as it is in cancer. In cells that look abnormal but can't be seen or felt or imaged, it's very, very, very difficult to predict their time course, and most do not progress. And we have evidence for this in the thyroid, in the breast, in the bladder, and also, I think, in the prostate. But multifocality has dominated thinking because of the way in which we've randomly sampled the prostate. And that tends to pick up microscopic disease that cannot be seen and cannot be imaged and therefore is subclinical. And that's been the part of all our lives for decades, and it's very, very difficult to forget or not to incorporate in our thinking. If you think about all other cancers, that's not done. What we do in all other cancers is either feel or image an abnormality and then interrogate that abnormal feeling or that abnormal image. And that'll be either an X-ray or something that you can feel or see. It might be a melanoma on the skin. It might be an abnormality on a kidney on ultrasound or in the liver on CT scan. You don't interrogate the whole organ. If you do, you find multifocal disease, but we don't do that, and therefore we don't find it. And the breast, I think, is an excellent example of that, in that you do a mammogram and you interrogate the abnormal bit of mammography or MRI or the palpable lesion, in other words, the clinical phenotype, but you don't sample the rest, even though breast cancer surgeons know that both the involved breast and the uninvolved breasts are riddled with multifocal disease, but they don't seem to recur and they don't seem to progress. And that has been nailed now with two Lancet articles comparing whole breast radiotherapy with just irradiating the lesion. So it's not multifocality that causes recurrence, it's recurrence within the scar of the original excision. And this multifocality issue comes up again and again, and I think is the experimental side of the treatment. And therefore we have to decide who is eligible for focal therapy. Is it men who have, let's say, disease in the top left-hand corner of the prostate and no disease evident elsewhere? And even if no disease is evident elsewhere, we know that disease will exist if we repeat the biopsies enough times. Or do we define a threshold of disease above which we declare it to be significant and below which we ignore? This won't arise, obviously, if we use an imaging-based sampling strategy as we do in all other cancers. But for the time being, the latter approach is one that's been offered by many other commentators, including Ian Thompson and JAMA, who is arguing, amongst others, that the Gleason 3 plus 3 that we call cancer isn't cancer at all and should be called something like IDLE, I-D-L-E, indolent lesion of epithelial origin. And if that were to happen, then we would get rid of most of the multifocality, inverted commas, and we could concentrate on identifying and treating Gleason 4 and Gleason 5 disease, because Gleason 3 had been relegated as a non-cancer. So I'm going to stop a second, because I've covered quite a lot of ground and I've gone on for a bit, but I've tried to highlight the areas that tend to get discussed when this approach to therapy gets mentioned. And this relates to case selection, it relates to oncological outcomes, and it relates to the difficult problem of multifocality. I'll just take a pause there.
So I think you've given us an excellent introduction. Thank you. I have a couple of sort of immediate follow-up questions. The first one relates to just how small a volume of tumor within the prostate, or rather how small a volume of tissue we can treat focally at the moment, mm-hmm. and whether you think we are going to be able to get to much smaller volumes than that. And the second one relates to patient selection in terms of other factors. Because one can do something doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do. And obviously, comorbidities and other factors need to be taken into account in deciding who to treat. And that comes back to the question of how one does define a risky prostate cancer at all. In other words, you know, is true low-risk cancer really not cancer, or is the patient's mindset about it, in fact, a key part of the decision process? So I'd be interested in your comments on those two aspects.
Great. So let's do the latter one first. So the other thing that's happened in the last 5 years is an improvement in the precision of risk stratification. Urologists talk about half of my patients are upgraded radical prostatectomy, and what they're actually observing is imprecise risk stratification. What they're saying is that my ability to stratify the risk of the patient in front of me is wrong half of the time. Right? This is a phenomenon we all recognize, and it's a function of the truss biopsy, which misses disease, misclassifies disease, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's very well known about now. And if you have that degree of error, it is not unreasonable to overtreat, because if you don't overtreat, you will undertreat. And therefore, the just-in-case approach stands up to, I think, reasonable scrutiny. And that's been driving a lot of the whole gland approach to treatment. So you have low-risk disease, sir, as far as we can tell. Your PSA is 5.5. You've got 1 millimeter of Gleason 3 plus 3 in one core and 2 millimeters in a core next to it. And we've repeated your biopsies and haven't found anything. Now, the urologist knows and will communicate the uncertainty to the patient that allocation of low-risk status is insecure, and therefore the patient may be encouraged to have prostatectomy just in case. What's happening there is the prostatectomy is serving as the kind of diagnostic test coupled with a therapeutic test, which will be unnecessary in many cases and necessary in some because of the imprecision of the original test. With imaging and image-guided biopsies now, we've got to a stage where the upgrading at radical prostatectomy doesn't occur in 50% of the times. In fact, it doesn't occur at all. In fact, overall, you get downgrading in 5% for technical reasons and the way that the Gleason has been derived. So we're now in a position, if you have an MRI before biopsy, which is, again, the minority of men get this, and you have good image-guided sampling with or without registration systems, we can get to a one-to-one concordance with radical prostatectomy, which means we can risk stratify patients with extraordinary precision. And that gives us a fantastic opportunity to not treat a large number of men, because we can be secure in the knowledge that they are low risk and probably have a 0.3, in other words, 100 times less the population risk of a prostate cancer-related death during their lifetime. We can identify men at high risk that were previously overlooked, and they might have multimodality therapy, including surgery, plus or minus radiotherapy and chemotherapy. But we can also identify men with aggressive disease that is localized, and we know they exist, with great precision. And they, luckily for them, might be suitable for a selective ablation, have their cancer their prostate de-risked, if you like, by having that cancer treated, to go into a surveillance kind of algorithm where PSA and MRI might be reapplied over an interval of time. So that's how I see it playing out. I see the growth in active surveillance and in focal therapy and surgery possibly being used in areas that it wasn't used before. So very well-characterized patients who are non-metastatic, who will have multimodality therapy, who have particularly aggressive and bulky tumors. And that picture I'm painting is one of personalized care or precision medicine, where you respond to the disease in front of you with an appropriate treatment strategy that reflects the risk of the individual. At the moment, the tragedy is that everybody gets treated the same, irrespective of grade, burden, multiplicity, and location of tumor, if you don't go to the bother of finding out where it is. So I think that hopefully explains the risk stratification issue. But you'll have to remind me what the first question was now.
The first question was how much tumor, what is the smallest volume of tumor that we can treat at the moment, and how much smaller do you think we can get?
Great. So I think at the moment we are really treating quadrants of tissue. So this is about 5 to 10 mils of tissue. If we assume that the average prostate measures 30 to 40 cc's, we are treating kind of blocks of 5 cc's. We can treat less, and some of the dose escalation studies that we've done using photodynamic therapy, which combines laser and a photosensitizer, required single fibers to be placed to measure the necrosis within the prostate. And there we were getting very, very tiny radiuses of treatment around the needle, which I think from memory went to 3 to 5 millimeters around the needle. So that would be about a 1 cc core of tissue. Some of the newer energy sources, such as NanoKnife electroporation, which uses electricity and is a non-thermal treatment, there are some bipolar needles that are being developed that, again, could treat about 1 cc of tissue. Some of the newer cryotherapy needles, these are so-called third-generation needles, again, will create an ellipse, a bit like a lollipop of tissue destruction with a very hard edge around them, again, going from about 1 to 2 cc's of tissue. That does raise the question of when does a prostate cancer become significant? At what volume does a prostate cancer merit therapy? And I think risk is conferred by volume, because it is in all other cancers. Why should the prostate be different? But also by grade, and of course volume and grade are very closely correlated. So volume's not a bad indication. MRI can detect 0.5 cc lesions, which are about 8 millimeters across, very well indeed, with very high sensitivity, very high positive predictive value. It can identify high-grade 0.2 cc lesions, again, with similar levels of sensitivity. But much below that, lesions will be systematically overlooked, which I think is probably a good thing, because that's a disease that probably doesn't need to be identified and treated.
Okay, great. So now I'm going to bring in the other panel members, and I would ask them we'll do this one at a time. I'll ask them to introduce themselves, say a little bit about themselves, and then, you know, they've probably each got a couple of questions for you.
Right.
I'm going to begin with Jim Wickstrom, who was actually treated by HIFU, so we consider him to be the expert on the panel.
Yes, he is. Jim, hi.
Hi there, Mark. I'll avoid my first question about can we find any pictures of your famous sock collection on the Internet, which I've heard is expensive.
Well, I'm wearing purple today. Yeah.
Oh, my favorite color. Thank you. Well, you know, it's been fascinating. I can't write fast enough in this discussion here, but, I was a HIFU patient who went down. I had a 5.65 PSA and a Gleason score of 6, but I had 9 out of 12 cores positive, so
yeah.
I really couldn't do active surveillance. And that's when you're really going to cut to the chase, because when you have a doctor telling you that you should do radiation, who's selling radiation, and you have the surgeon telling you, like, he can only spare 50% of my nerve bundle, you know, I had red flags going up. So ultimately, I did my research. I interviewed the FDA biomed engineer to find out about HIFU, and I did my research by interviewing dozens and dozens of patients, because old guys will cut right to the chase and just tell you stuff. And that is where I learned so much. But ultimately, I did HIFU with Dr. Stephen Cianti out of Boston, and I can't rave about how my procedure went and how happy I am, but again, having interviewed so many patients that have found that there was misdiagnosis. And when you mentioned, I assume it's what you're doing is something similar to Artemis, which means, you know, diagnosing using an MRI before the biopsy, maybe fusing it to an ultrasound so you can actually create a 3D image of the tumor to see where to do the biopsy makes so much sense. And yet here in the U.S., so many doctors really, I hate to use the word archaic, but they're just not informed about what's out there, either due to cost or by just not have no research on it. But how often, my question is, how often is your facility doing MRIs first before you do biopsies?
So I think that's just a great question. So in our public facility, we're NHS, so free at the point of delivery, we've been offering MRI to every single patient with a high PSA prior to biopsy now for 6 or 7 years. The same has happened in Lille and also in Nijmegen, and that process is diffusing very rapidly throughout Europe. And you're quite right, not quite as quickly in the U.S. I think there is a kind of moral issue too. You know, if you speak to urologists, they will tell you that they would prefer to have an MRI before a biopsy, because who wouldn't? Because there's no harm, there's no radiation, there's just cost and 40 minutes of your time. But that will give you the opportunity to avoid a biopsy possibly, or indeed to have a better biopsy if you need one. So I think everything I've said is contingent on location, and that location is driven by MRI and verified by a targeted registered biopsy. You're quite correct. We don't use the Artemis system. The Artemis is an excellent system, which is Canadian invented, US distributed, and helps get the MRI information onto the ultrasound. There are about 10 companies now that will offer to sell you software, which is largely a result of computational mathematics to allow that process to occur. We use several of them. We're developing our own, as many other units are. But the key, the absolute key, is MRI prior to biopsy. You're quite correct.
Thank you. Should I go on?
Yes, Mike.
I keep losing Dr. Amberton. Am I the only person?
No, I'm here. I'm waiting for the next question.
No, he's here.
Yeah, okay. Jim?
Yes?
Do you have another question for Dr. Amberton?
Well, I'll try to make this one short. I'm fascinated by how the implementation of the Affordable Care Act is happening in the U.S. And we've got some controversy here that is quite publicly known as the physicians and physician groups, maybe urology oncology groups, who choose to have their patients do MRIT, for example, and they're self-referring. And so here we are in the system of a private enterprise in the United States where patients aren't getting the true picture of what's best for their particular situation. And yet you're running more of a socialized medicine, I believe, in your area, and you're able to do things the way you see best for the patients as opposed to the U.S. Do you see the U.S. transitioning to a more patient-centered, consumer-based arena? Or do you think that we're going to be floundering around in the U.S. with patients not being able to figure out what's best for them because they believe they're individual doctor?
I think this is very important. So I think programs like this are critical, and I think this will be driven by patients, much in the way that lumpectomy was in women with breast cancer. And men will have to insist, and the marketplace will respond to accommodate that they have imaging prior to a biopsy. If you don't have, yesterday was fascinating. I had an American physician with me who works out of Florida. He's a urologist, came with his radiologist to learn about what we're doing, and they're going to take back a lot of what we do back to Florida. We saw several patients one patient had three biopsies before, all negative, rising PSA, 15 by the time I saw him, and the patient afterwards had four previous biopsies done, and the PSA was now 21. We did an MRI, and they both had large anterior lesions, which are T3A disease, in other words, locally advanced disease, and their PSA had been rising over the preceding 5 years. And you can imagine the distress and the anger that they felt getting the same test time and time again that was never, ever equipped to detect their disease. And by the time we did detect their disease, it was probably not curable. It won't take long for this message to get out there, especially that the test is widely available and can be applied. You don't have to buy this. It's, you know, all hospitals have a scanner. Most private facilities have arrangements with local providers to provide MRI. But there are a few things that are stopping it in the States. One is the cost. The cost of MRI in the States is unusually high, and it can vary between $2,000 and $3,000. In Europe, it's much, much cheaper, even when done privately. And at most, in the best facility that we have in the UK, it's around $1,000 for an MRI. It's a few hundred dollars in a NHS public facility, because obviously that machine is working almost 24 hours. So there's a cost issue, and the insurers have to be prepared to allow the urologists to do the MRI beforehand. NYU, Memorial Sloan Kettering, Johns Hopkins, UCLA are all now doing MRI prior to biopsy. The academic centers have persuaded the insurance companies that this is a good thing. And I think many of the insurance companies are slowly learning about this. And the other thing I think is professional competition gets in the way. This does require a urologist to work very closely with a radiologist in harmony. I need the radiologist's skills to tell me where the tumor is, and the patient then needs me to use my skills to direct the needle into the tumor, or indeed the energy into the tumor. So we have really good working relationships with the radiologist. So we discuss cases together, we work together, and that was so nice about this visiting surgeon from Florida who came with his own radiologist, and they're both going to work together to improve the service they offer patients.
So thank you.
If I may, I'm going to bring in our next panelist, and Alan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So, Alan, go ahead with your introducing yourself and your questions for me.
Sure. I'm in Los Angeles. I often act as a patient advocate. I belong to several prostate cancer support groups and spend a lot of time online doing that. I was treated about 3 years ago using SBRT by Dr. King out here. It's commonly called CyberKnife. What I would like to get back to actually is Mike's opening question about active surveillance. I've been looking at Dr. Klotz's 10-year study, and he had 97% cause-specific survival on active surveillance, and two-thirds of the men required no treatment at all, and one-third did opt for radical treatment. I'm wondering, given the success, overwhelming success of that, is there still a niche for focal therapy? And at the other end, owing to radical treatments like the one I had, SBRT or HDR brachytherapy, which have extremely low rates of side effects and extremely high cure rates, does that sort of squeeze out focal therapy?
So focal therapy is not in competition to active surveillance. I don't treat anybody with low-risk disease, and we go to huge efforts to characterize men as low, medium, or high risk. And we have published definitions of what we mean by that. So focal therapy is in competition with whole gland therapy in order to reduce toxicity. All the treatments that you mentioned are being looked at, are first of all capable of focal treatment, and are being looked at in trials as we speak for focal therapy. And radiotherapy is particularly interesting for focal therapy, and that can be in the form of seed brachytherapy, HDR brachytherapy, or indeed CyberKnife. Because if you plan focally, you can increase the dose to the tumor and increase efficacy and diminish the dose to the parts of the prostate or surrounding structures that you don't want to treat, or indeed render the dose absent. And so the opportunity in radiotherapy is, I think, greater than in the ablative therapies because of this opportunity to dose escalate in the area that you want to. The reason that radiotherapists can't increase the dose around the tumor is that they're limited by the dose that they can apply to bowel and to bladder, etc., and that limits the upper limit. Once they reduce the target to a smaller area within the prostate, which they can now because they have the necessary information, they can almost double the dose that they administer to that and at the same time diminish the dose to the parts that matter. So focal therapy is an opportunity to improve the efficacy of radiotherapy and also to diminish its harms. And in the area of brachytherapy, to reduce costs, because you'll be using less seeds. You pay for each seed. Most seeds are unnecessary. They're treating normal tissue. And you can use fewer seeds and place them around the tumor with a greater dose. And there are trials at Memorial Sloan Kettering, UK, and also in Paris looking at that opportunity. So it's win-win-win, whichever way you look at it. But importantly, the three treatments that you mentioned are capable of selective ablation.
Alan, do you have a follow-up question?
Yes. Also on the subject of multifocality, since about 80% of the time prostate cancer seems to be multifocal, and with many of the foci below the limits of detection of even multiparametric MRI, I'm wondering about identifying appropriate patients. I don't know if you saw it, but last week there was a study published by Hafner from Johns Hopkins, and it was only an anecdotal study, a case report of one man where there was a lethal metastatic lesion, and they traced its origin back to the prostate, where they found that it had originated in a very low-grade cancer focus from the primary tumor. I don't know. It was just in one man. I don't know if Yep. It's true of lots of people. But if that kind of thing is generally true, will focal treatment ever really be curative?
Well, that observation, I mean, there's a Hafner and Leal. I haven't seen that paper. But the trouble with these papers is that lesion, we don't know the direction of travel. So if somebody's got metastatic disease, that lesion could be a metastasis. You don't know that it was the origin. All you know is that they share some genetic material. So there's a kind of directional causality issue that is always raised. And that goes against all our thinking about cancer. So, you know, all risk models of cancer relate to grade. That's why grade exists, low, medium, and high. Men with high-grade disease have a high probability of dying of the disease. Men with low-risk disease, as you've just told me, with active surveillance, have a low probability of dying of disease. In fact, the latest thinking is that Gleason 3+3 has never killed anybody, in that it's never metastasized to bone or to lymph nodes in many tens of thousands of men. So whilst I take that observation, obviously haven't read it, it goes counter to everything that we know, not just about prostate cancer, but also against all prostate cancers. And if that is true, if that single observation in one man is true, and the observations that we've made in hundreds of thousands of men is incorrect, then we all have to pack our bags and go home. So I think that
Fair
case
enough.
Is interesting. I'd love to know more about it, but I don't think it's representative of most of the disease. You know, I have a 50% chance of having prostate cancer today. I'm 53, talking to you tonight. That's the rate at which I might have microscopic focal disease. You know, most of us, all of us, will, if we live long enough, will have prostate cancer, and yet the background rate, a lifetime risk of death, is 3%. So there's a huge discrepancy of prevalence and incidence. So I'm happy with uncertainty. What we've done is try to define a threshold above which we will treat, and that includes Gleason pattern 4 or Gleason 3+3 above a certain volume in 0.5 cc's. That's almost certainly incorrect, but you've got to start somewhere. And at the moment for the trials, we've created an upper threshold for disease beyond which we won't treat because the risk of metastatic spread is so high that we wouldn't know if focal therapy made a difference or not. And so at the moment, we have an upper limit of disease of Gleason 7, so dominant pattern 4, there's no limit on multiplicity or indeed on volume, and a PSA of 15. And I think that's reasonable and legitimate, you know, in phase 1 and phase 2 studies. The important take-home message, I think, is that we don't treat low-risk disease. We watch it. I think in the UK we probably have more surveillance than anywhere else in the world. And clearly we're not completely mad and are not treating focally Gleason 8, 9, and 10. You know, they are getting standard multimodality therapy as you'd expect. As we learn more and more about disease, as our targeted biopsies give us representative tissue so we can subject it to genomic deep sequencing, we will learn more about what constitutes a lethal lesion versus a non-lethal lesion. So there's a lot to learn, but the opportunity for learning is in observing these small lesions, which focal therapy gives us. If you halt the story with radical prostatectomy or radiotherapy, you will never learn. So the only models in which we can learn about disease are active surveillance and focal therapy. And therefore, that's one justification for them. And at the moment, I think we're doing it within the bounds of safety and within trials, which have obviously gone through patient panels and international review boards or ethics committees, as we call them here. So I think it's a legitimate approach, but yes, uncertainties do remain.
So at this point, I'm going to bring in Rick Davis, who's our last panelist. Rick is very involved as a patient advocate with the group at the University of California, San Francisco. Rick, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. Hello, Dr. Emberton.
Hi.
As Mike mentioned, I do a lot of work at UCSF. I was diagnosed in 2007. I had high-risk disease. I selected IMRT plus brachy. I had over 2 years of hormone therapy, largely because I wasn't a good candidate for the surgery. I figured I'd need that anyway. And since then, I do a bunch of advocacy. I sit with folks you probably know, Peter Carroll and Mac Roach, who was my doc, and Chuck Ryan and others on the advocacy board there and the research. My question is about the role of focal therapy for salvage treatment, where a patient has already had sufficient radiotherapy. I'm wondering what the role is for cryo and for HIFU. I've seen more recently that we're starting to use cryo for salvage therapy, and I'd just like to hear your thoughts and your comments on that.
Yeah, great question. So one of the fascinating things about radiorecurrent disease is that it's more likely to be unifocal than multifocal. So recurrence tends to be focal, and that's fantastic for us in terms of treating, because it means we can limit the energy to a small proportion of the prostate, whether it be through heat or cold, and therefore limit toxicity. The trouble with treating at the whole gland level, you know, surgery, for instance, after a high dose of radiotherapy, and you've had the absolute limit of dose with IMRT and HDR, that's the mechanism by which you can get most dose into the prostate, is that if you do anything to the prostate, because of the blood supply, healing is compromised, and the side effects like incontinence and rectal injury are very high. So we've published a couple of papers now.
We know.
So and they are devastating. You will know patients who've had either or both of those, or sometimes worse, complete stricturing of the prostate afterwards, and left with suprapubic catheters that block and get infected, et cetera, and end up with an ileostomy. It's an awful, awful situation. So again, it's imaging. It's MRI and CT choline PET that allow us to localize the disease and then target our therapy to the disease and preserve tissue. And then if another lesion appears 2 or 3 years later, we can treat that in the way that we treat bladder cancer. And that has diminished the toxicity significantly. And we recently published our first series doing focal therapy using HIFU, but we're using cryo as well, and we'll be using other energy sources in the future to do this. In terms of oncological efficacy, the freedom from disease rates look very, very similar to whole gland treatment, as you'd expect. And this population obviously have a high proportion of these men have microscopic metastases at the time of treatment, and sadly recur distally, not locally. So I think the opportunity for men who do recur after radiotherapy, and some of these recurrences can occur quite late, if picked up early, in other words, when the PSA starts to rise, we can identify these foci very, very clearly on MRI. And the bit of the MRI that's critical is the gadolinium component, because the background signal of the prostate, the blood, because of the way that radiotherapy works, the blood supply is reduced. There's an endarteritis. So in other words, radiotherapy works on the small blood vessels, and therefore the background signal is very homogeneous. There's very little noise, and the cancers light up like light bulbs. They're very, very clearly seen and very visible. And if caught early, can be very small, and may be amenable just to one needle treatments, which can be done, you know, in 10 minutes as a day case procedure.
So at this point, we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I know we've probably got some patients online with questions. So Priya, I'm going to hand it back to you to see if we can get a couple of questions from our listeners.
Thank you, Mike. We have actually a lot of people lined up to ask questions live on air. Professor Emberton, I'll be bringing them one by one. We have around 8 to 9 minutes. Maybe quickly, briefly, we can try to get all of them in. Yeah. The person calling in from 515276, please ask your question.
Yeah, hello. That's me. Two quick questions. One, who's the doctor in Florida you're talking about?
I don't know. He hasn't given me permission to broadcast his name.
Okay.
But he works out of Jacksonville.
Okay. Second question.
I don't think it's fair for me to name him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Second question. A lot of the places that I hear in the U.S. are doing MRI prior to biopsy. They're doing what's called a cognitive MRI. Do you know, is that familiar to you, that term?
Sure.
How does that compare to getting the something with like the Artemis system or?
Fine. So the cognitive bit refers not to the MRI, but to the way in which the targeted biopsy is done. In the only study that's compared cognitive versus computer registered, cognitive won. And if you look at one study that's published under my name, recently published in J. Urol, I think we have the. This is a cognitive me looking at the MRI and then firing the needle. I think that's the study with the highest detection rate currently in the literature. So cognitive in good hands works very well, but you have to be fairly skilled, and I think the learning curve is quite long. What registration does is allow somebody who's not been used to doing this. I mean, we've been doing it for years and years and years to get up to speed to kind of super pro level, you know, overnight. Because the target is presented on the ultrasound, it's not a difficult procedure to do.
Mm-hmm. So one follow up. So can they, when you're doing a cognitive biopsy, can you use the ultrasound to kind of see where that funny thing on the MRI actually is? Or is it invisible on the ultrasound?
Ultrasound itself doesn't usually detect the abnormality. What MRI tells you to do is where to deploy the needles. So if you're doing cognitive biopsies, you tend to have to use a few needles to overcome the error. What the registration does is take the information from the MRI, transfer it onto the ultrasound. So when you look at the ultrasound, you see this little halo or area that looks pink or whatever color they choose to make it, and you can stick your needle right into it. So your accuracy goes up. And therefore, the number of needles that you will require will go down, and you're more likely to get a direct hit, and therefore representative tissue, which allows you to then risk stratify accurately.
Right. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you. Great question.
The person calling in from 718-767-2262, please ask your question.
Here in the U.S., using NanoKnife for prostate cancer is very, very new with no long-term data. Is there any long-term data on its use for prostate cancer in the U.K. or elsewhere?
No. I've done more, I think, than anybody else currently. I think I've done 26 cases. We've just teamed up with Sydney to pool our data, and that paper is just being submitted, but there is no long-term data. The longest follow-up we have is 18 months. It's a very nice technology. It's a very quick technology. I think it's a very good tissue destructive technology. It can create very nice, small, neat lesions and preserve architecture. So I'm very, very excited by it, and it's non-thermal, but there is no long-term data.
So, Dr. Emberton, I have a quick question before we get the next person online. How many different forms of focal therapy are you actually using at the moment?
So I diminish the importance of the energy source. I think the types of focal therapy relate to your definition, your ceiling and floor definitions of disease. So the first trial we did was anatomically defined, so it was a hemiablation study. So you treat the left lobe or the right lobe, a bit like doing a left or right mastectomy. The second study that was published in Lancet Oncology was any cancer that we detected was treated, which is a completely different approach. And the third one, which has not been published yet but just about to be submitted, is an index lesion approach where we treat disease above a certain threshold and knowingly leave disease below a certain threshold, And that's a kind of what I call an index lesion approach. And that study is just about to be submitted. There's another study now with long-term outcome using that approach, which I think is the way forward. And so I see the big differences in focal therapy as the kind of approach to the disease. I think the energy just needs to be tailored to the individual. If the lesion is very anterior, I can't reach it with HIFU because I have a 4-centimeter focal length, but I can reach it with NanoKnife, and I can reach it with cryo. If the lesion is very posterior, then HIFU is an excellent source for treatment. So I think the focal therapist of the future will have to use a number of energy sources, including radiation sources as a potential role for focal therapy, and in the future, possibly injections. And we may be able to turn focal therapy into an outpatient procedure where through image registration we just inject a toxic substance into the cancer. Remember, these lesions are fairly small, under local anesthetic, so it'll be a bit like going to the dentist. And that's the way I see it playing out in the future.
Thank you. And so, Priya, perhaps you can bring our next question online.
Yes, Mike. The person calling in from 585-244, please ask your question.
Hello. I have two quick questions. First of all, it's my understanding that here in the U.S., the FDA has not yet approved HIFU. I thought I was going to have to go to Toronto, Canada, to get it, but I heard someone earlier mentioning a doctor in Boston. I think the name was Pianti or Chianti, something like that, and then you mentioned somebody in Florida. So can it be gotten here in the U.S.? And the other question is, can you elaborate on the advantages and disadvantages in terms of success rate and side effects and so on for, between the different focal therapies like cryoablation and HIFU and some of the others?
This is not a quick answer. So so first of all, you cannot have HIFU in the U.S. FDA jurisdiction. You have to go out of border. So you have to go to Canada, and I think Dr. Schionti works out of Bermuda or some other places. I've worked with Dr. Schionti. He's an excellent HIFU and cryotherapist. He's a very, very, and I'm increasingly doing more and more focal. So he's, I can vouch for him. I've worked with him. I've seen him operate. I've heard him lecture. We're good friends. But you would have to have your treatment outside FDA jurisdiction. In Canada, there are also some very good focal therapists. In Toronto, so I think those two sources would be good, but otherwise you can't have it done. I don't think there's much difference between the therapies. I think there's slight differences in toxicity between the approaches. If you treat less than half the gland, you can pretty much guarantee preservation of erections. Got more publications coming out on that. The less you treat, the more you can keep ejaculate. I think incontinence now is a thing of the past in focal treatment. I actually don't bother telling patients they'll be incontinent because incontinence is so incredibly rare. And we spend our time discussing the quality of the ejaculate rather than potency or continence, when we meet postoperatively.
So will somebody still be fertile if it's focally treated?
I think fertility is... So somebody tells me they care about fertility, I ask them to preserve semen and ask them to try and conceive naturally because, as we know, fertility is all about maximizing probability. So it's not a guarantee. I can't offer any guarantees in that respect, and I would be very, very cautious if somebody still wanted to have a family. But, the usual things would apply. Save semen, try and defer the intervention and spend those 3 to 6 months trying to conceive naturally.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think we probably reached our limit, haven't we?
Yes, Mike. Just one last question. Professor, what is the cost for a U.S. national to receive a HIFU therapy in London?
Come in. Sorry, hello. What does it cost, what?
What is the cost for a U.S. national to receive HIFU therapy in London?
It would be around... £11,000, so about £13,000 to £14,000. You'd have to do the conversion rate yourselves. So that's the current cost. That's the complete cost of hospital stay, equipment, surgeon, and anesthetic fee.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. I think, Our time. And Professor Emberton, I think it has been an absolute pleasure to have you with us today. Mike, Jim, Rick, thank you for a very informative discussion. And Dave, we thank all our listeners for their support, and the link for today's discussion will be sent via email to all participants. We hope to meet all of you for our next Cure Panel Talk Show, which is on the 7th of November. We're talking about yoga for healing. Please visit trilex.com/curetalk for all details on our upcoming shows. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Emberton. It was a pleasure.
A great pleasure. Bye-bye.